So imagine you're managing millions of dollars for a client,
Right.
and you need to execute this massive block of trades. Now, one broker offers to do it for $5 a trade,
Okay.
but another broker, like right down the street, is offering to do the exact same trades for $10.
Yeah, double the price.
Right, exactly. Double.
Right.
And as a fiduciary, you're legally bound to act in your client's best interest. But what if I told you that in certain situations, not only is it perfectly legal to pay the guy charging double, but the regulators might actually prefer it?
It sounds totally backwards. I know.
It really does. So we are going to unpack that whole counterintuitive mystery today. But before we jump in real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Which is huge.
Yeah, it's so helpful. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
Okay, so moving on.
Yeah, paying double on purpose is a wild concept.
Right, but it makes complete sense once you understand the hidden grammar of financial regulation.
A hidden grammar. I like that. And that is exactly our mission today. We're taking this massive stack of sources, so SEC rulebooks, FINRA guidelines, Series 99 exam prep materials, and we are just extracting the absolute core logic.
Yeah.
Specifically, we're diving into function two of the Series 99 outline, which is the section that covers relationships and dealings.
And if you're listening right now, please sit up, pay attention.
Yeah.
Because this single function represents 15 scored items on your exam.
Wow.
Yeah, that is 30% of your entire exam.
30%.
It's the whole ball game. You can be an absolute genius at operations and trade clearing, but if you don't understand how a firm interacts with the outside world, you will not pass.
Yeah, 30% is make or break. So if
Ugh.
you have ADHD like I'll do, or if you're just totally exhausted from reading dry legal textbooks that feel like they were written in, I don't know, the 1800s,
Right.
we are throwing the traditional study methods out the window today. There is going to be no brute force memorization. We are going to build a mental movie.
I love that.
Yeah, we're bringing in this cast of recurring characters, and we're going to use absurd analogies and real-world hypotheticals to explain the why behind the rules.
Which is really the only way to retain it.
Exactly. Because when you understand why the SEC or FINRA wrote a rule, you don't have to just memorize a flashcard.
Right.
The right answer on the exam will just reveal itself.
Yeah, the regulators aren't just making up rules to torture you. I mean, it feels like it sometimes,
It does.
but they aren't. Every single rule in this section was written because at some point in history, someone did something terrible.
Right.
And the regulators had to step in and say, okay, we have to stop this from happening again.
Yeah.
So if we trace the logic of the rule back to the risk, it's trying to prevent it all just clicks. And really, the very first place risk enters a financial firm is through communication.
Communication.
Yeah, before a firm can open an account or manage money or hire a vendor, it has to talk to people.
But in the financial industry, how dictates the rules, right? Like, we don't just talk.
No.
We have three incredibly specific buckets for written or electronic communication. There's correspondence, retail communication, and institutional communication.
Right.
And I've always sort of thought of this as a sliding scale of the blast radius. Like, the more everyday people you reach, the tighter the leash the regulators put on you.
The blast radius is actually a fantastic way to conceptualize it.
Yeah.
Let's start with the smallest radius. Bucket number one is correspondence. So by definition, this is any written or electronic communication that is distributed or made available to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period.
Okay, so 25 or fewer. I always picture correspondence as like a group text to your buddies,
Yeah.
or maybe an advisor sending a very personalized email to three specific clients about a municipal bond. It's targeted, it's low volume.
Exactly. And because it's such a small group, the risk of mass market manipulation or some kind of widespread deception is relatively low.
Right.
I mean, the firm still has to supervise it and review it, but it doesn't require a manager to pre-approve every single text message before you hit send.
Which would be an operational
It
knife
would be
run.
impossible. But the moment you cross that threshold, the moment you send that message to 26 retail investors in 30 days,
So just one more person.
just one more, you step into the second bucket, which is retail communication.
So if correspondence is the group text focus,
Yeah.
retail communication is like renting a giant billboard on the highway,
Yes.
or blasting out a mass newsletter, or running a Super Bowl commercial. Like, anyone and everyone driving by can see it. And because it's a billboard, the regulators are terrified of what you might say.
They are terrified of promissory language. They're terrified of misleading performance charts because this communication is reaching a large retail audience,
right.
And that's an audience that might not have the financial sophistication to spot a really bad deal.
Yeah.
So the rule changes drastically. For retail communication, a registered principal generally must approve the material before the earlier of its use or its filing with FINRA.
Before its use.
Yeah.
That is a massive operational difference.
Huge.
You can't just design the billboard, put it up, and hope compliance likes it later.
No, you definitely can't.
A registered principal, so someone who actually carries the licensing liability,
right,
has to formally sign off on the exact wording beforehand. Because if that billboard lies, it's their license on the line.
Precisely. And then we have the third bucket, which is institutional communication.
Okay.
This is written or electronic communication that is made available only to institutional investors.
Only to them.
Only to them. So we're talking about banks, savings and loans, insurance companies, registered investment companies, or honestly, any entity with $50 million or more in total assets.
So the heavy hitters.
Yeah, the big players.
And the logic here is that institutions can just fend for themselves, right? Like, if an insurance company with $500 million gets an email with a really complex, maybe slightly risky financial projection, FINRA just assumes they have the lawyers and the analysts to figure it out.
Exactly.
They don't need the same hand-holding as a retail investor.
That is the exact underlying philosophy. Institutions are sophisticated. So institutional communication does not require pre-approval by a principal.
Okay.
But there is a really vital asterisk in the rulebook here. Institutional communication excludes a member firm's internal communications.
Wait, say that again?
Internal memos between your own traders, they don't count as institutional communication. It has to be external.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, I want to pause here and actually put the listener on the spot.
Let's do it.
We're going to do a pop quiz. So if you're listening, stop what you're doing and actually formulate the answer in your head before we give it away.
Yeah, don't just wait for the answer.
Right. Okay, here is the scenario.
Yeah.
Your firm drafts a highly detailed market outlook email about the tech sector. They load it into their marketing software and they blast it out to 500 everyday retail investors who have signed up for your newsletter.
Okay.
What bucket does this fall into and what is the mandatory regulatory control?
Think about it.
I'll give you a beat. 500 retail investors.
Email blast.
Okay, so if you deduced that it is a retail communication, you are absolutely correct.
Nailed it.
You cross that threshold of 25 retail investors. And because it is a retail communication, the control is that a registered principal must approve it before it goes out.
Okay, that feels pretty straightforward. Group text is correspondence. Billboard is retail. Big banks are institutional.
Right.
But looking through the SEC rulebook, it feels like there's a trap hiding in the terminology here. What is the trick they use on the exam to mess this up?
Oh, the exam writers love this one. They love to blur the lines between the method of communication and the privacy rules surrounding the data within that communication.
They'll weave this narrative that involves both trying to trick you into applying a communication rule to a privacy issue.
I see. So they might see something like, a trader uses an approved institutional communication channel, like a highly secure encrypted institutional email portal to send a message. Because the channel is institutional, are they exempt from regulation SP privacy requirements regarding the attached customer data?
Exactly. And the answer is a resounding no.
Right.
The channel you use, whether it's a retail newsletter, a correspondence email, or an institutional portal, is completely separate from the information you are discussing.
Yeah.
Using a secure institutional megaphone does not give you a free pass on consumer privacy rules.
I really love the megaphone analogy. The communication method is just the physical pipe.
Right.
And the information is the water flowing through the pipe. Just because you have a really sturdy approved pipe, it doesn't mean you're allowed to pump toxic sludge through it.
Yeah.
Two completely different sets of rules.
Yes. Keep them in entirely separate boxes in your brain, which actually naturally leads us to examine the water in the pipe. Let's do it.
We've established how we talk. Now we need to look at the actual content we are legally obligated to protect.
And to do that, let's introduce the very first character in today's mental movie.
Yes.
Cautious Carla.
Let's hear about Carla.
So Cautious Carla is extremely private. She shreds her junk mail. She uses a VPN just to order a pizza online.
Oh, wow.
She pays for her coffee in cash. Carla does not want anyone anywhere knowing her business.
Good for her.
Yeah. And she is going to help us understand Regulation SAP, which is this massive rule governing how covered financial institutions treat non-public personal information.
Regulation SP. So this was born out of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999.
Okay.
Congress basically realized that as banks, brokerages, and insurance companies were all merging into these massive financial conglomerates, they were passing around incredibly sensitive consumer data like a plate of cookies.
Just sharing it with everybody. Exactly. And Red SP put a stop to that. But before we get to the data itself, we have to figure out who Carla actually is to the firm, because the legal obligations change entirely based on her title.
Okay.
We have two categories, consumers and customers.
Okay, let's play this out. Scenario one. Carla walks into a brokerage firm on a Tuesday. She buys a very specific one-time municipal bond for her personal household portfolio. She hands over her check, she gets the bond, she walks out the door, and we literally never see her again. What is she?
She is a consumer.
Consumer.
Yes, a consumer is an individual who obtains a financial product or service primarily for personal, family, or high school purposes. It was a one-off transactional interaction.
Right. Okay, now scenario two. Carla comes in, buys that bond, and then sits down with an advisor and says, you know what, I like this firm. I'm going to open an ongoing managed brokerage account here. I want you to rebalance my portfolio every quarter.
Okay.
What is she now?
Now she has crossed the threshold. She is a customer.
Customer.
A customer is simply a consumer who has a continuing relationship with the financial institution.
So a consumer is a retail transaction. A customer is an ongoing subscription, basically.
Yeah, yes.
But why does the SEC care about the difference? Like, if they both get their privacy protected by Reg SP,
right.
Why does the continuing relationship matter so much?
It comes down to the operational burden of notifications.
Okay.
Both get protection, yes, but the ongoing relationship of a customer triggers ongoing regulatory paperwork.
Oh.
When Carla is just a consumer, so a one-time interaction, the firm generally only has to give her a privacy notice if they plan to share her data with an unaffiliated third party.
Right.
If they aren't sharing it, they don't even necessarily owe her the initial notice.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But the moment she becomes a customer with an ongoing account, the firm must provide an initial privacy notice and an annual privacy notice every single year she keeps the account open, regardless of whether they share the data or not.
Oh, I see. Sending out tens of thousands of annual privacy notices that cost a lot of money and administrative time.
Tons of time.
So the firm only wants to bear that burden for the people actually sticking around and generating revenue and customers.
Exactly. It's a really critical distinction for compliance departments. Now let's test your grasp of the nuances here, because I know exactly how the test writers try to weaponize this definition.
Bring it on.
Let's imagine cautious Carla isn't just managing her household money. Let's say she's an entrepreneur and she owns a wildly successful commercial baking company called Carla's Croissants.
I love croissants.
They're the best. So Carla walks into your firm to buy payroll management and financial services for her bakery. Are the bakery's financial records protected by Reg SP?
Okay, let me think about this. Reg SP is for personal privacy, but she's a person, so, oh wait, no. The purpose of the service isn't personal, it's commercial. So I'm guessing the answer is no.
The answer is an emphatic no.
Really?
Yes. And if you are listening right now, burn this into your memory. This is an enormous exam trap.
Wow.
Regulation SP is consumer privacy law. It explicitly covers individuals obtaining services for personal, family, or household purposes. So information about companies or even individuals obtaining services for business, commercial, or agricultural purposes falls completely outside this specific consumer privacy scope.
That is wild. Mm. So Carla the mom, setting up a 529 college fund for her kid, fully protected by Reg SP.
Yes.
Carla, the CEO, getting a commercial line of credit for Carla's croissants.
Yeah.
Not protected by Reg SP.
That's right.
The exact same human being walking into the exact same building, but the purpose of the money dictates the federal protection.
That is the perfect way to summarize it. The regulators basically assume that commercial entities have their own lawyers, their own non-disclosure agreements, and the sophistication to negotiate their own data security terms.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They don't need the blanket consumer protection that's designed for everyday households.
Personal, family, or household.
No.
If you're taking notes, underline that phrase three times. Personal, family, or household.
Yeah.
Okay. Assuming Carla is acting as the consumer for her household, what exactly are we protecting? The study outline calls it NPI, non-public personal information. What does that actually mean in the trenches?
So NPI is personally identifiable financial information that is not publicly available.
Right.
The SEC breaks down how a firm obtains this into three distinct avenues. First, it's information Carla provides on an application to obtain the product or service. So her social security number, her stated income, her net worth.
The basics.
Right. Second, it's information that results from a transaction. Her account balances, her trading history, her credit card charges.
Okay.
And third, it's information the firm otherwise obtains while providing the service. Like maybe they pull a credit report on her from Experian.
Basically anything tied to her identity that isn't already plastered on a public record.
Exactly.
But here's where the rules get really fascinating. And frankly, a bit of a data science nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
The outline says MPI also includes derived consumer groupings.
Yes.
What on earth is a derived consumer grouping?
Well, think about the massive databases these broker-dealers maintain. Millions of data points. Let's say a firm runs a query on their database, and they pull out a specific list.
Okay, so if we run a query, and we create an Excel spreadsheet titled People in Zip Code 90210 who panic sold their tech stocks on a Tuesday in 2024.
Okay, very specific.
Right, that list itself, even if it just has their first and last names on it, is protected MPI.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Because that grouping was derived using personally identifiable financial information that is not publicly available, namely their trading history. So the list itself becomes MPI.
Just because of how they made the list.
Exactly. Even if their names and zip codes are technically public information, the fact that they are on the specific list reveals their private financial behavior. Therefore, the whole grouping is protected.
That's crazy.
The only exception is if you create aggregate or blind data where you completely strip out all personal identifiers.
So if the firm's marketing deck just says 40% of our clients panic sold tech stocks this year, that's totally fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
But the second it identifies Carla as part of that 40% public, it becomes radioactive MPI.
Yes.
You can't just launder private behavior data into a spreadsheet and call it public.
You cannot. And because this MPI is so sensitive, the regulators don't just ask firms to keep it safe out of the goodness of their hearts.
Right.
They mandate written safeguards. Covered institutions must maintain written, administrative, technical, and physical safeguards.
And this is highly testable. The SEC gives three specific objectives that these written safeguards must achieve. So if I'm building this compliance manual, what are my three goals?
Okay, objective one. The safeguards must ensure the security and confidentiality of the customer information.
Keep it locked up, keep it encrypted, keep it secret. Got it.
Objective two, they must protect against anticipated threats or hazards to the information's security or integrity.
So build the firewall.
Yeah.
Stop the hackers, but also maybe stop the server from melting down during a power outage. Anticipate the hazard.
Exactly. And objective three, and this is the exact regulatory phrasing you need to brand into your brain for the exam.
Listener, pay attention to this.
They must protect against unauthorized access or use that could cause substantial harm or inconvenience to any customer.
Okay, I want to zero in on that phrase. Substantial harm or inconvenience. It's not just about preventing a minor embarrassment.
No.
Like, if someone hacks the firm and steals Carla's social security number, leading to identity theft.
Yeah.
That is obviously substantial harm.
Right.
But what is an example of substantial inconvenience?
Well, imagine a technical glitch in the firm's unpatched software that locks Carla out of her trading account for a month during a massive market crash.
Oh, man.
Yeah, she hasn't lost her identity, but she is massively inconvenienced and potentially losing money because she can't access her funds.
That would be a nightmare.
It would. The written safeguards have to specifically target preventing those exact outcomes.
That makes total sense. Now, what if the firm actually wants to share Carla's MPI? Let's say we have an affiliated bank and we want to share her data with them.
If it's an affiliated entity, meaning part of the same corporate family, the rules are much looser.
Okay.
But if the firm wants to share Carla's MPI with a non-affiliated third party, a completely separate outside company, they have to give Carla a privacy notice and a reasonable opportunity to opt out before they share anything.
Meaning she could just check a box and say, no, please don't sell my trading history to that random marketing company.
Exactly. And she can exercise that right to opt out at any time.
Nice.
There are a few legal exceptions. For instance, if you are sharing the data with a printing company just so they can mail Carla her own account statements, she can't opt out of that because it's necessary to service the account.
Right. They need to mail the statements.
But for marketing purposes, she completely holds the power to opt out.
All right. So we've got communication methods down. We know we have to protect cautious Carla's MPI, and we know exactly what constitutes MPI.
Yep.
But here is the reality of modern finance. No broker-dealer operates on an island. You can't do everything in-house.
Not anymore.
No, we have to hire outside companies. We need someone to build the cloud servers, someone to shred the physical paper documents, someone to host the proprietary trading algorithms. Which brings us to the second character in our mental movie.
Yes.
Vendor Vince.
Vendor Vince, what critical infrastructure is Vince trying to sell us today?
So Vince runs a massive tech infrastructure company. We are bringing him in to handle our primary data storage. We're going to take all of Cautious Carla's NPI, all the data we just spent 20 minutes legally protecting.
Right.
And we're going to hand it over to Vince to store in his servers. Obviously, before we sign that contract and hand in the keys to the castle, we have to do our due diligence at selection.
Due diligence at selection is a fascinating area of regulation because it's principles-based.
Okay.
It really boils down to one fundamental overarching question that the firm must answer. Is Vendor Vince capable of performing the function?
Is he capable?
Everything we evaluate is just a subset of asking, can he actually do this safely, securely, and effectively without violating SEC rules?
So how do we figure that out? Like, we can't just read his Yelp reviews.
No, definitely not.
The outline gives us six specific areas of review. Well, let's rapid-fire analyze Vendor Vince through these six regulatory lenses to see if he's capable. Lens number one, standing.
Standing means looking at Vince's financial condition, his operating experience, and his industry reputation. Is his company financially stable? Has he successfully managed financial data before?
Right, so if Vince is funding his server farm with high-interest personal credit cards and he's facing bankruptcy, his standing is terrible.
Terrible.
Because if he goes under, our data is trapped.
Exactly.
Lens number two, regulatory fit.
This one is critical. Does Vince have familiarity with the regulatory requirements that apply to the function he is taking over?
Okay.
If he is storing broker-dealer data, does he know what regulation SP is? Does he understand SEC books and records requirements? Or is he just a generic tech guy who usually builds websites for local auto mechanics? He needs to fit the regulatory environment of finance.
You can't just hire a guy who says, trust me, the cloud is safe. He needs to know the actual law.
Right.
Lens number three, incentives.
We have to look at Vince's fee structure and the behavioral incentives it creates. How are we paying him? Are we paying him in a way that accidentally encourages him to cut corners on security?
Give me a hypothetical of a bad incentive structure.
Let's say we pay Vince a flat fee, but he has to cover all the underlying hardware costs himself.
Okay.
His incentive is to use the cheapest, oldest, least secure hardware possible to maximize his profit margin.
Oh, I see.
Or what if we pay him based on data compression speed? He might disable the encryption protocols just to make the data transfer faster and earn his bonus. We have to follow the money and see how it affects his behavior.
That is brilliant. Follow the money. Lens number four, people.
This involves checking the background of the vendor's principals and key personnel. Who is actually running Vince's company? Do the executives have a history of financial fraud? Are they competent? You are evaluating the human element.
Lens number five, controls.
This ties right back to Cautious Carla. We need to evaluate Vince's risk management programs and his information security controls. Does he have the technical and administrative safeguards in place to protect the NPI we are handing him? Is his firewall robust? Does he use multi-factor authentication?
And the final area, lens number six, resilience. I love this one.
Me too.
If a Category 5 hurricane hits Vince's server farm in Florida, or a massive ransomware attack takes down his primary network, can he keep our systems running? I always picture this as evaluating Vince's apocalypse bunker.
Yes.
We aren't just checking his resume, we're checking his backup generators.
Mm-hmm.
If the grid goes down, can Vince still route our trades?
The apocalypse bunker is a great image, and it's exactly the right mindset for evaluating business continuity. Regulators are obsessed with systemic resilience. But here is an incredibly important nuance that the exam will test you on. The depth of this six-point review scales with risk.
Explain what it means to scale with risk.
Imagine we are hiring a different vendor. We're hiring a guy to water the office plants in the lobby.
Okay, plant guy.
Do we need to investigate his apocalypse bunker? Do we care about his cyber resilience?
Definitely not.
No. The review is minimal because the risk is minimal. But if Vendor Vince is hosting our primary trading algorithm or storing all of our customers' social security numbers, the review must be incredibly deep documented and thorough.
Right.
The riskier the function, the deeper the due diligence. You apply the six lenses proportionally.
That makes perfect sense. Don't spend 100 hours investigating the plant guy.
Exactly.
But wait, what if Vince is outsourcing some of his own work? Like, what if Vince gets the contract, but then he turns around and hires his cousin, subcontractor Steve, to actually store the data? And let's say subcontractor Steve keeps all our firm's data on an unencrypted laptop at a local coffee shop.
This is explicitly covered in the rules. The firm must consider the vendor's review of its subcontractors.
Really?
Yes, you cannot just wash your hands and stop at Vince if Vince is handing the keys to Steve, especially when a subcontractor could reach sensitive firm or customer non-public information or touch a critical firm system. The chain of custody matters, and you are responsible for making sure Vince is vetting his own people.
So if subcontractor Steve touches the MPI, Steve gets scrutinized too. Got it. Now, I want to throw a massive warning flag up for anyone listening. Stop multitasking and hear this, because I am about to save you from one of the sneakiest traps on the entire Series 99 exam.
Pay attention to this.
The exam is going to give you a multiple choice question about vendor selection. And one of the answers is going to sound incredibly official. It'll say something like, before hiring the firm must complete the mandatory five-step SEC vendor selection checklist and file Form 44B.
Sounds very legitimate.
It does. Is there a magical Form 44B?
It is entirely fabricated.
Totally made up.
No rule sets a fixed vendor selection checklist, a required government form, or a mandatory number of steps for due diligence. The SEC intentionally uses principles-based regulation here. They know that technology changes way too fast to prescribe a rigid checklist. These six areas, standing, regulatory fit controls, etc., are simply areas a firm considers to determine reasonableness. It's a framework. If an answer choice describes a required fixed standard procedure or a mandatory SEC form for vendor selection, it is a trap.
They want you to think there's a bureaucratic checklist, but there isn't. It's about reasonableness. Is Vince capable? Can he prove it based on the risk? Yes.
Yeah.
Then hire him.
Exactly.
So we have communicated with our customers using the right megaphone. We have protected their private data. We have successfully navigated hiring vendor Vince to build our cloud servers. Now we actually have to do some business. We have to execute trades in the open market.
Time to make some money.
Which brings us to the final character in our trio, Broker Bob.
Broker Bob. We are stepping into the realm of commission management and soft dollars. And this is an area where a lot of candidates get tangled up because, as we hinted at the very beginning of the show, it feels completely counterintuitive to normal business logic.
It really does. So here is the setup for the listener. You are an investment manager. You have a discretionary account, meaning you make the trading decisions for your client, and you need to execute a bunch of trades today. Broker Bob comes to you and says, I am an institutional prime broker. I will execute your trades, and I charge $10 a trade.
Okay.
But another eligible broker down the street says, I'll do the exact same trades for $5 a trade. Direct question to the listener. As a fiduciary, someone legally sworn to act in the best interest of a client's money, shouldn't you always 100% of the time pick the $5 guy? Why on earth would you ever pay Broker Bob double the commission for the exact same execution? Take a beat and think about it.
On the surface, paying $10 instead of $5 looks like a massive breach of fiduciary duty.
It really does.
It looks like you're wasting the client's money, or worse, engaging in some kind of kickback scheme.
Yeah.
But there is a specific exemption in the Securities Exchange Act called the Soft Dollar Safe Harbor under Section 2080.
Okay, why does this safe harbor even exist?
It goes back to May 1st, 1975. Before that day, brokerage commissions were fixed. Everyone charged the exact same amount. When the SEC finally unfixed commissions and allowed them to float competitively, managers panicked.
Why?
They realized that if they were legally forced to always pick the absolute cheapest broker, they would lose access to all the valuable research and financial analysis that full-service brokers provided.
Oh.
So Congress created Section 2080. This safe harbor allows you to pay Broker Bob the higher commission if and only if you are getting qualifying brokerage and research services in return from him.
Ah, I see. So it's not just paying $10 for a trade. It's paying $10 for the trade plus a bunch of incredibly valuable proprietary macroeconomic research reports that Bob's team writes.
Exactly.
And that research helps me, the manager, make better overall investment decisions for the client.
Yeah.
So the client is actually benefiting from the higher commission.
Yes. The extra $5 is essentially paying for the research with soft dollars rather than writing a hard check out of the firm's pocket.
Right.
But you cannot just declare soft dollars and do whatever you want. To legally qualify for the safe harbor and avoid a fiduciary lawsuit, three very specific conditions must be met.
Okay, let's break them down. Condition one.
Condition number one. The person making the decision to pay the higher commission must actually have investment discretion over the account.
Discretion.
Yes, you can't just be a back office administrative clerk paying high commissions for fun. You have to be the one making the investment choices because you are the one who actually needs the research to help the client.
That tracks logically. The fiduciary duty is to the beneficiary. So the manager needs the research to help the beneficiary. Condition two.
Condition number two. The recipient of the higher commission broker, Bob, in this case, must actually be an exchange member, a broker, or a dealer. You cannot pay soft dollars to some random, unregistered consultant or a buddy who gave you a stock tip at a bar. Keep it in the regulated family.
Makes sense. Keep it regulated. And condition number three.
Condition number three is the most subjective, but it's where the SEC focuses its audits. The decision maker must determine in good faith that the higher commission is reasonable in relation to the value of the qualifying brokerage and research services they are receiving.
Okay, let's test that good faith and reasonable standard. Let's say Broker Bob says, hey, pay me $10 a trade instead of $5, and in exchange, I will buy you a massive tomahawk steak dinner every Friday, and I'll give you a novelty magic 8-ball to help you pick stocks.
Oh, man.
Does that qualify for the safe harbor?
Absolutely not.
No.
No. A steak dinner, travel expenses, office furniture, or a toy are explicitly not qualifying brokerage and research services. If regulators look at that arrangement, they're going to say your good faith determination of value is completely bogus and you have breached your fiduciary duty.
But what if Bob says, pay me $10 a trade and I will give you unlimited access to our proprietary institutional data feeds Bloomberg terminals and our deep dive macroeconomic analysis algorithms?
Now you are firmly in the safe harbor. That is qualifying research. And notice how the regulatory outline phrases the reasonableness test. You can evaluate that value for the particular transaction or for your overall responsibilities across all the accounts under your investment discretion.
Oh, that is a huge nuance. So even if that specific $10 trade doesn't directly use the macroeconomic algorithm, if the algorithm benefits my discretionary accounts overall, the higher commission can still be considered reasonable.
Yes.
It's a holistic view of the value you're getting for the accounts you manage. It's not a microscopic trade-by-trade analysis.
Yes, you nailed it. But here is the ultimate gotcha for soft dollars on the exam. A higher commission never qualifies automatically. Let me repeat that because it will definitely show up on your test.
Listener, lean in.
The higher commission never qualifies automatically.
So if an answer choice says paying a higher commission is always a violation, that's wrong. And if it says paying a higher commission is always fine, that's also wrong.
Correct. The higher commission alone doesn't make it unlawful, but it doesn't automatically make it legal either. It only becomes legal if you have investment discretion. The recipient is a broker-dealer, and you make that good faith, reasonableness determination tied to qualifying services.
Right.
If any of those three pillars are missing, the safe harbor collapses and you are in violation.
It's all conditional. Which leads us to a really interesting crossover scenario. Broker Bob is a registered broker-dealer. He is legally allowed to receive commissions.
Mm.
But what happens if someone who is legitimate wants a piece of the action? Let's bring vendor Vince back into the story.
Oh, Vince.
This is Section 5, the red flag, commission payments to unregistered persons. So Vince is doing a great job running our cloud servers. One day, Vince calls us up and says, hey, my buddy down at the country club just sold his company, and he's looking for a new wealth manager. I referred him to your firm, and he just deposited $5 million.
Nice referral.
Right. Since I brought you the lead, I want a 1% commission on all the trades you do for him. Now, Vince is a tech vendor. He is not a registered broker dealer. So my immediate gut reaction, and I bet the listener's gut reaction too, is Vince is unregistered. Boom. Illegal. Do not pay him. Is it really that black and white?
That is exactly the trap candidates fall into.
Really?
Yes. Unregistered status alone is not the complete test.
Wait, why not?
The regulators don't just look at his job title. You have to look at what Vince actually does and whether those specific actions, the actions tied to the compensation, require broker-dealer registration.
Okay, unpack that. The baseline rule is that a member firm generally cannot pay transaction-related compensation to an unregistered person. But the pivot point is the actual activity.
Yes. The prohibition applies when the payment and the recipient's related activities require broker-dealer registration. The SEC defines a broker as someone engaged in the business of effecting transactions and securities for the account of others. Historically, the SEC has been very aggressive in saying that soliciting clients, referring clients for a fee, and routing retail money into the market is the very definition of activities requiring broker-dealer registration.
Ah.
They really want a gatekeep who can hawk investments.
So in this specific scenario, paying Vince the 1% referral commission would be strictly prohibited.
Mm.
Not just because he's unregistered, but because his activity soliciting and referring for a cut of the trading action requires registration and he doesn't have it.
Exactly. Now let's flip it to contrast the logic.
Okay.
What if we just pay vendor Vince a flat $10,000 a month to maintain our computer network? He's still unregistered. Is that payment prohibited?
Well, no. Because maintaining a computer network is not an activity that requires broker-dealer registration.
Right.
The payment isn't tied to a regulated activity like selling securities.
You see the difference. It's not just, is he registered? It's, does the thing he is doing to earn this specific money require him to be registered?
That makes total sense.
Don't just look at the label, look at the action. Identify the payment, identify the recipient, and critically identify the activities tied to the compensation.
That is a phenomenal distinction. If Vince is fixing the Wi-Fi, cut him a check. If Vince is acting as a shadow broker, bringing in assets for a commission, shut it down. All right, take a deep breath.
We covered a lot.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the mechanics of the communication megaphone. We moved to safeguarding Cautious Carla's deepest financial secrets. We interrogated vendor Vince's apocalypse bunker. We paid broker Bob for his fancy research algorithms and finally shut down Vince's illegal side hustle.
It is a really dense web of regulation, but remember, this is 30% of your exam. This is the core operating system of how a firm actually interacts with the real world.
Let's do a massive energy shift right here at the end. We are going to do a rapid-fire recap to lock these concepts into your short-term memory before you hit the practice exams. Let's do it. I'm going to set up the premise and you deliver the punchline. We're calling this the top five testable takeaways. Takeaway number one, communication. If you send a written message to an audience of 500 everyday retail investors, it is a retail communication. What is the mandatory control?
A registered principal must approve it before use. And remember, the trap communication methods are totally separate from privacy rules. The pipe is not the water.
Takeaway number two, privacy. Regulation SP protects non-public personal information. But who does it actually protect?
It protects consumers, individuals getting a product for personal, family, or household purposes. It does not protect commercial businesses. Sorry, Carlos Croissants, you are on your own.
Takeaway number three, vendors. When you select a third-party vendor, you are evaluating if they are capable of performing the function based on risk. What is the big exam trap regarding the regulatory procedure?
There is no fixed SEC checklist or mandatory form. The review scales with risk, and you must consider subcontractors if they touch sensitive information. Subcontractor Steve and his coffee shop laptop definitely matter.
Takeaway number four, soft dollars. Paying a higher commission for trades is allowed under the safe harbor. But what conditions must be present?
The decision maker must have investment discretion. The recipient must be a broker-dealer, and there must be a good faith determination that the commission is reasonable relative to the value of the research services. Higher commissions never qualify automatically. No tomahawk steaks or magic eight balls allowed.
Takeaway. Number five, unregistered persons.
Yeah.
You generally cannot pay transaction-related compensation to an unregistered person. But what is the actual legal test?
Unregistered status alone is not the answer. The test is whether their actions tied to the compensation require registration. Focus on what they're actually doing to earn the money.
Bam. That is function two in a nutshell. If you can visualize Cautious Carla Vendor Vince and Broker Bob, you're going to absolutely crush these 15 questions.
I agree. But before we wrap up, I want to leave everyone with a final thread to pull on. Something to think about as you continue studying. We talked a lot about written correspondence and emails today. But think about how fast communication technology is accelerating.
Oh, yeah.
If a firm uses an advanced AI chatbot to talk to everyday consumers on their public website, is that correspondence? Is it a retail communication? If a registered principal has to approve retail communication before it's used, how do you get a principal to pre-approve an algorithm's live generative chat?
Whoa. That is a wild thought. You can't approve what it hasn't said yet.
Exactly. The regulations are constantly having to sprint to catch up to the technology. But the rules you are studying today, the fundamental principles of blast radius risk scaling and protecting consumer data from substantial harm, these are the exact same philosophical frameworks regulators are using right now to solve the tech problems of tomorrow. You aren't just memorizing old rules, you're learning the grammar of financial regulation.
The grammar of financial regulation. Keep that in mind as you prep. You're not just passing a test. You are learning how the industry actually thinks. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, trust the process, and go crush that Series 99 exam. We'll see you next time.